Fields of force. The cyclic nature of the academic year causes me each new session to have to reaffirm the essential premise and strategy of my proposals in the presence of those who have not previously attended these lectures. I have to say then that, as I've said previously on two similar occasions, November 2010, November 2011, that these Oxford lectures are not intended to be received as programs or proposals or expositions. They have more the nature of contortions, though not, I trust, of merely willful exhibitions. Thus circumstanced, my self-appointed word for what I do is agon. The original expositions have become, over the past 2 years, bouts of self-wrestling as I submit myself to understand myself insofar as I'm able to comprehend what it is I'm struggling to achieve 3 times a year in your gratifying and gracious presence. I'm the first to admit that it is an odd business. What is this weird and demanding discipline? Why does it not get through, except as a travesty of itself? One's own method is to some extent compromised by public pedagogic strategy. There is a faculty demand to be met weeks or even months before the writing becomes an urgent necessity. A title has to be supplied, so that advertising, the commissioning of posters can begin. The presumption behind all advertising, not unreasonably, is that one has something to sell. But I have no mind to sell poetry, particularly contemporary poetry, to anyone. I do not think that it is an attractive proposition. Now, contrary to excited opinion, there are poets among my contemporaries whom I greatly admire. But the general prospect is bleak. The title that I submitted to the faculty office some time ago now was Fields of Force. I did so because I had particularly in mind two quotations, at that time recently read or reread, which I will not at this point specify, though I intend to explain their significance for me before the end of the hour. Even now I am dissatisfied with my choice. I ought perhaps to have supplied the phrase lines of force, thereby enabling myself to exploit an ambiguity. Lines would, in the first sense, suggest magnetic radii, power-bearing cables, and punningly also would introduce a historical topic of dispute, a topic of dispute in mid-17th century poetics, when such writers as various as Thomas Hobbes and Isaac Walton declared or implied reservations about the strong lines associated with the metaphysical verse written 50 or so years earlier. I would have been able to compound historicism with what remains to me of practical criticism skills. Something or somewhat of the burden of this present discussion is nonetheless impinged upon by the title on the posters. Impinged upon by the title on the posters. How I wish I could stop acting and sounding like Jeeves. The Jeeves to the various high powers that have employed my attention for the past 60 years. Though the situation does, of course, always invite self-parody. And though there are several alternatives much worse than playing Jeeves, such as resembling the crazed octogenarian recluse in a rather poor play by John Whiting, the poet poorly imagined is in old age too often a visionary driven mad by public rejection. Whereas, as Yeats splendidly articulated in his late correspondence with Margot Ruddock, the old poet's concentration must be a final clarifying of lifelong attention upon the matter of technique. I actually think now that the phrase heaviness of the world prevailing would have been a title best indicating what it is I endeavor to say. Not only what I will say in this, but also have said in previous and will say in succeeding lectures. Heaviness of the world prevailing. That phrase comprises one line from a poem discovered by me, age 19, browsing in Blackwell's. My copy of a volume entitled Selected Poems still has in a very schoolboyish hand the ownership signature, Geoffrey Hill, Oxford, 1951. The author of that particular selected poems, an American poet by the name of Richard Eberhardt, drew my attention at that time, as much as did the work of the young Robert Lowell. I was put onto him by my new friend Donald Hall. I still feel a powerful force field of sympathy for both poets as they revealed themselves to me then. Note, by the way, that I said discovered while browsing in Blackwell. I was not directed to read Eberhardt or Lowell, either by the official syllabus, which in any case terminated at 1832, or by the tutor of a creative writing class in poetry. There were no classes in creative writing in the UK then, though they had already started in the USA. Eberhardt's poem reads as follows. Its title is Mysticism Has Not the Patience to Wait for God's Revelation, Kierkegaard. But to reach the Archimedean point was all my steadfastness. The disjointed times to teach courage from what is dreadful. It was the glimpses and the lightning made me a sage, but made me say no word to make another fight, my own fighting heart, full of dismay. Spirit, soul, and fire are reached, and springs of the mind, like springs of the feet, tell all know. Nothing wavers there. All the flowers of the heart turn to ice flowers. Heaviness of the world prevailing. The higher we go, the more terrible it is. Duplicity of man, heart hate. The hypocrite, the vain, the whipper, the cheat. The eternal ape on the leash, drawing us down to faith, which the Greeks call divine folly. The tug of laughter and of irony. Always useful to hear a new poem a second time. Mysticism has not the patience to wait for God's revelation, Kierkegaard. But to reach the Archimedean point was all my steadfastness. The disjointed times to teach courage from what is dreadful. It was the glimpses and the lightning made me a sage, but made me say no word to make another fight. My own fighting heart, full of dismay. Spirit, soul, and fire are reached, and springs of the mind, like springs of the feet, tell all know. Nothing wavers there. All the flowers of the heart turn to ice flowers. Heaviness of the world prevailing. The higher we go, the more terrible it is. Duplicity of man, heart hate. The hypocrite, the vain, the whipper, the cheat. The eternal ape on the leash, drawing us down to faith, which the Greeks call divine folly. The tug of laughter and of irony. This poem first appeared in book form in 1947 in Eberhardt's collection Burr Oaks. If there is an earlier magazine dating, I do not have it. In 1938, there was the publication by Oxford University Press of the journals of Søren Kierkegaard, translated by Alexander Drew, D-R-U. And Eberhardt, in this poem, quotes three phrases precisely as they are given in Drew's translation. The title, Mysticism Has Not the Patience to Wait for God's Revelation, can be found on page 82, and it was entered on July the 11th, 1840. Line 12, All the flowers of the heart turn to ice flowers, is on page 46 and is an entry for 1837. The higher we go, the more terrible it is. An 1843 entry is on page 119 of Drew's translation. And a further citation of 1843, Faith is therefore what the Greeks call divine folly, page 122, is part used in the poem's penultimate line. The Archimedean point is a recurring trope throughout the journals and occurs elsewhere in Kierkegaard's writings. It is the hypothetical point in space where one who might wish to weigh or to move the Earth would have to stand. It is the hypothetical point in space where one who might wish to weigh or to move the Earth would have to stand. On July the 29th, 1835, the journal entry reads, he, meaning the solitary inquirer, has found that Archimedean point from which he could lift the whole world, the point which for that very reason must lie outside the world, outside the limitations of time and space. If we repassed on being told this, how arbitrary, how ungainly, how uncouth are such demands on the reader's attention. The riposte itself is countered first by Kierkegaard, then by Eberhard. Kierkegaard, in effect, says, the impossible demands are crucial to one's salvation, and in making them, I myself have become an impossible person. Eberhard, some 70 years ago, is adding, the equivalent labor of lifting the art of poetry from A, simple subjectivism, and B, socio-political explanations of inequity and injustice colored with a Marxist populist tinge. Is to take on an impossible labor. And I think Eberhard, in picking on the, on enlightening upon the Kierkegaard, Eberhard is implying something like, well, we really must abrupt the expected lyrical continuities as you might find them in the poetry of, say, Robert Frost. Frost, it is true, was fully apprised of the political economic stresses in the United States of the pre- and post-depression years, but he remained an extremely canny writer and was adept at playing lyrical games with a wide readership, a few of whom, such as Edward Thomas, read for cadence and nuance, but of whom by far the greater proportion expected the poet to be fiddler of platitudes and truisms. Now, Kierkegaard in 1938, when Drew's translation of the journals appeared, had barely begun to be known in the English-speaking world. And Eberhard would at that time have been an adventurous and an exemplary close reader. And his quotations are well taken from the journal's hefty spread of 1,410 citations and 570 or so pages of text. Should you ask me what Eberhard's poem is about, I would respond that it is about achieving an objective relation to one's own subjectivity. It is about achieving an objective relation to one's own subjectivity. And I'm once more alluding, when I say that, to Alexander Drew's English rendering of Kierkegaard's Danish. I will risk, and anyone who embarks on Kierkegaard is at risk, I will risk the suggestion that of all the citations in the 1938 volume, it could well have been this one, number 1376, that most directly called forth Eberhard's sympathetic, creative, poetic attention. And this is how the Kierkegaard reads. The majority of men are curtailed eyes. That's not E-Y-E-S, that's I apostrophe S. The majority of men are curtailed eyes. What was planned by nature as a possibility capable of being sharpened into an I, is soon dulled into a third person. It's a very different thing, Kierkegaard, it's a very different thing to have an objective relation to one's own subjectivity. Take Socrates. In danger, he has an objective attitude to his own personality. And when he is about to be condemned to death, speaks of his condemnation like a third person. He is subjectively raised to the second power. His attitude is as objective as that of a true poet to his poetic works. He is just as objective to his own subjectivity. Take Socrates. In danger, he has an objective attitude to his own personality. And when he is about to be condemned to death, speaks of his condemnation like a third person. He is subjectivity raised to the second power. His attitude is as objective as that of a true poet to his poetic works. He is just as objective to his own subjectivity. I even say that an essential aim for every good poet throughout the greater part of the 20th and of the toehold we so far possess in the 21st centuries has been to achieve, by a variety of technical means, the effect of possessing an objective sense of one's own subjectivity. This poem of Eberhardt comprises 20 lines in the form of 5 four-line stanzas, mostly unrhymed, though there is the occasional rhyme, and the metric is very variable, mingling iambic with trochaic, anapestic, and so on. Most lines in the poem display what Gerard Hopkins termed counterpointing, where the line takes a basic meter, iambics say, but the sense, the meaning of the line, imposes a colloquial speech stress on the final metrical feel of the line. Oft had I heard of Lucy Gray. Oft had I heard of Lucy Gray. So that the melody, the two melodies, add up to the third melody, which is the true melody of the poem. It is one of the great abiding beauties of English poetry that we can do this. And it is as much present in a Shakespeare or a Sidney sonnet as it is in the Eberhardt poem immediately under discussion. To all this, one must add that 2 and a bit of Eberhardt's lines are lifted straight out of prose. All the flowers of the heart turn to ice flowers. The higher we go, the more terrible it is, which the Greeks call divine folly. These lines do not share a metric with each other, nor do they share a metric with any other line in the poem. It is Eberhardt's self-imposed task so to engage these statements in the mechanics of the thing that they do not immediately shout prose or prosaic at us when we read, any more than the other lines shout poetry at us when we read. And when I say read, I mean either silently or aloud. Eberhardt's solution is to pitch the whole thing in quasi-extemporary rhetoric, to produce an overriding effect of gains made by short, sharp rushes and abrupt pauses, as if the poem were being extemporized, even as we read it silently or aloud, from some awkwardly shaped jetsam, some recalcitrance of incompatibility between meaningful utterance and the world's contingent intractabilities. Since this poem, here laboriously destructured and restructured by a crabbed and willful octogenarian, revealed itself instantaneously, I believe that I truthfully so describe its effect to the half-tutored intelligence, uncertain of all its certitude, of a young man browsing in Blackwell's, Geoffrey Hill, Oxford, 1951. And since my sense of what poetry is, what its demands are, has not significantly changed in the succeeding 61 years, you may find it possible to understand why it is that I believe the greater proportion of poetry in English written at the present time is selling itself short. Dare I say this? There is one poet writing today whose achievements meet every criterion that I have sought to establish for poetry, and which will be remembered when the work of currently famous poets has fallen into obscurity. But I am sorry to say that I do not know who she is. Again, let us put up a straw figure. Let's say I sit here so that you can accuse me of being a mere laudato temporis acti. I cannot love thee as I ought, for love reflects the thing beloved. My words are only words and moved upon the topmost froth of thought. Yet blame not thou thy plaintive song. The spirit of true love replied, thou canst not move me from thy side, nor human frailty do me wrong. What keeps a spirit wholly true to that ideal which he bears? What record? Not the sinless years that breathed beneath the Syrian blue. So fret not like an idle girl. That life is dashed with flecks of sin. Abide, thy wealth is gathered in when time hath sundered shell from pearl. Tennyson held that the world, by a slow Aeonian movement of evolution, was ever bettering itself and moving toward one far-off divine event. This hopefulness of his, this ultimate optimism, forms one of his great charms. I quote both the poem and the critical encomium from a collected Tennyson published in 1917, when it must have been striking many minds that the world was self-deflecting from any course of ever bettering itself. One can hear that Tennyson's quatrains and Eberhardt's quatrains move to quite different pulses. And if we next look at one of Eliot's quatrain poems from Poems 1920, we shall be alerted to yet another quite different pulse. Tennyson's metric and stanzaic pattern are magnificently attuned to what the 1917 encomium terms a slow Aeonian movement of evolution. But we stick upon the question of how it accommodates fictions other than slow evolution. My words are only words and moved upon the topmost froth of thought, upon the topmost froth of thought. This reservation has to be managed by Tennyson in exactly the same pace and cadence that he employs for the most intense lyrical affirmation. Which elms that counterchange the floor of this flat lawn with dusk and bright, and thou with all thy breadth and height of foliage, towering sycamore. One grasps immediately the significance of the word counterchange to any just appreciation of the epic lyric art of Tennyson. It would be a fair question to put to any young student poet. Show how counterchange is effected in In Memoriam, where the metric pace and rhyme scheme are so stable. How convincing do you find Tennyson's self-accusation that at times his words are only words and moved upon the topmost froth of thought? I would argue, I remember this room very well in its former business. Faced with that, I would argue that nowhere in In Memoriam do words resemble a mere spindrift, a froth, blown across the measured waves of ABBA tetrameter. They're more solid than that. Where they're deficient, it is because they are solid, weighty, with an inappropriate kind of cultural aplomb, which answers a public demand for poetry to utter truisms with a becoming gravitas. Ring out old shapes of foul disease, ring out the narrowing lust of gold, ring out the thousand wars of old, ring in the thousand years of peace. Narrowing lust of gold, I suppose, suggests that ever-increasing financial greed constrains and curtails the broad social sympathies. But Tennyson must have thought rightly that greed was spreading, not being curtailed. So narrowing, though a thoughtfully odd choice of adjective, chosen to show that the poet is still alive and thinking, is not effectively odd. It merely happens to be odd, like a small grimace of petulance when you expect only the benign. And ring out means two different things, celebrate and dismiss or dissipate. Tennyson acknowledges both, but in an awkward rhetoric of elevated double entendre. Tennyson's dates are 1809, 1892. Kierkegaard was born in 1813, died 1855. It seems incredible to us now that they were of the same generation, even though in his youth Tennyson pursued a more actively or more flamboyantly radical life than did Kierkegaard. It's not so much activity, action, as perception, or rather the knack of making perception itself the vital form of activity that brings about such drastic differences between one literary legacy and another. The host with someone indistinct converses at the door apart. The nightingales are singing near the convent of the Sacred Heart, and sang within the bloody wood when Agamemnon cried aloud. And let their liquid siftings fall to stain the stiff, dishonored shroud. The two concluding stanzas of a 10-quatrain poem, Sweeney Among the Nightingales, included by Eliot in his tellingly meagre collection, Poems 1920, It is a high-handedness in the structuring that is the making of this poem. High-handed, when I am approving poetry, is as likely to be a term of commendation as of disapprobation. You have to watch me on this. I think that all poetry that is excellent has a certain high-handedness about it, a kind of take it or leave it, a kind of sod off to enjoyment. Joy, yes. Joy is fine, but enjoyment is possessive. And the poem doesn't want your possessiveness of it. It wants a kind of parity of meeting. But as I say, you have to watch me on that one. Eliot pushes things around to suit his final effect, which he means to be one of highly effective ineffectualness. Now, I don't believe that the content of the Sacred Heart has any significance other than as a bit of urban scrim. The young Eliot was more in touch with Buddhism than with Roman Catholicism, and when he converted, it was to High Anglicanism. What does excite him? What does excite Eliot in this poem is that he is about to work a transfiguration scene simply by using the word "and." And is going to reveal that the murder of Agamemnon by Clytemnestra is as much a shred of historico-literary scrim as is the Convent of the Sacred Heart, and that the Convent of the Sacred Heart is as redolent of tragic implication as is the murder of Agamemnon, but only if you insert the word "and" at precisely the right place as the defining fulcrum of two odd platitudes. And the final stanza is so pleased, and rightly so, with its mastery of effects. Look, it says, look, liquid siftings is at once a revived cliché about birdsong and an effective new phrase about bird droppings. Voila! Cried aloud, you say, is tautologically impotent. Of course he cried aloud. Could you cry? Not aloud. He cried aloud. But here also Eliot is inscribing something vital about the old poetic diction and the new. You, he says, looking up from your late Tennyson and your Loeb classics, you hear him cry aloud. I, having sat at the feet of Pound, realize that all can be transfigured by the power of logopoeia, the dance of the intellect, or of the intelligence among words. The last line of section 51, I think it is, it's 51 in the edition I used, it may be 52 in Rix's edition, to take up again that section that I quoted earlier, when time hath sundered shell from pearl. One can see here that Tennyson is intensely keen to break up the cliché. He composes a kind of concertina line. When time hath sundered is stale Victorian eloquence. Sundered shell from pearl is set against the first half of the line, an expressive abruption. Sundered is a gesture towards the action of ripping apart a stubborn carapace and discarding it. Laceration is briefly conjured. Spiritual consummation means doing painful things to the body. But then you see the immediate following lines in Tennyson are, how many a father have I seen a sober man among his boys? The metrical settlement of these lines is, to speak figuratively, the waters of the Tennysonian mere closing again after the briefest glint of a gesture, perhaps thought too abrupt to be entirely in good taste. Carl André, a 20th century American sculptor, whose work I have not seen, but from the descriptions that I've read probably wouldn't much like, gave a most intelligent interview some years ago in which he said that you have to make art as strong as the art you admire, but you can't make it like the art you admire. You have to make art as strong as the art you admire, but you can't make it like the art you admire. Now, I both admire and love In Memoriam, and I wish that Tennyson were now more read than he is. But to wish to write like Tennyson would be utterly absurd. Wilfred Owen believed that to write like Tennyson in 1917 would be immoral, even wicked, but plenty of people between 1914 and 1918 still did so, as did Lawrence Binion, as did Owen himself, even in his finest things. His profoundest cadences of mourning still have something of the High Victorian in them, quite as much as do Lawrence Binion's. Even his syntactic inversions are as Binion's. Why speak not they of comrades that went under? Why speak not they of comrades that went under? The last line of one of his very greatest poems, Spring Offensive. Much of what I'm trying to debate on this occasion could be subsumed into the question, what does Yeats mean by the vortex of Empedocles? This is, in fact, one of the two quotations which at the beginning of the lecture I said I would hold over until we were around the halfway point. The other quotation is from Ezra Pound, the closing lines of Canto 74. Certainly a property of the mind, nec accidens est, but an element in the mind's makeup, est agens and functions, dust to the fountain pan otherwise. Hast to seen the rose in the steel dust, or swans down ever? So light is the urging, so ordered the dark petals of iron, we who have passed over Lethe. Yeats's allusion to the vortex of Empedocles occurs in a piece of writing from 1929, in which he alludes to the capacity for automatic writing dictated by spirits manifested by his wife shortly after their marriage. A number of phrases were given to Yeats in this way, and he put them to use both in a vision and in his late poetry. Empedocles of Akragas is a pre-Socratic which, as a group, a thought nexus, profoundly influenced Gerard Hopkins, D.H. Lawrence, Eliot, Pound, and, as we see here, Yeats. By profound, I intend to mean an originating radical depth rather than the weight of received opinion or sentiment. Let me try another mock tripos topic. Trying to paraphrase Yeats's meaning in the vortex of Empedocles. Okay, what holds words together in such forms that they appear to us as paradigms of reality? If we answer semantic energy, should we envisage that energy as radiating from a psychic quirk that some, that is to say great writers, possess, and that others, that is to say inane poetasters, do not? Or is the energy objectively there through history, laid up like mineral strata, by the growth and decay of eons of cultural idiom, to be activated at any time, not by the power of individual genius, but by the impersonal machinery of culture, such as the online edition of the Oxford English Dictionary. If the trigger is individual genius, do we intend by such words as great poet, someone extraordinarily sensitized to the reception of messages from the semantic strata? Well, I would say, I hope we mean that. The great poet, someone extraordinarily sensitized to the reception of messages from the semantic strata. My sort of version of Yeats's Anima Mundi. Hugh Kenner defined the vortex as a circulation with a still center, so I believe as a hurricane. Rationalists and skeptics will say that vortex is a word, a locution like any other, and that only a fantasist like Yeats could wish to suggest that a linguistic hierarchy would so summon into being cohorts of beneficent or malign spirits. We have come to give you metaphors for poetry. It is, of course, an attractive idea. And here I lean for effect upon the word attraction. What if attraction is more than we think it is? No, what a foolish thing to say. You young people know perfectly well what a power attraction is. Why am I? Think again of the pound that I've read earlier. Certainly a property of the mind, nec accidens est, but an element in the mind's makeup, est agens, and functions, dust in the fountain, pan otherwise. Hast thou seen the rose in the steel dust, or swans down ever? So light is the urging, so ordered the dark petals of iron, we who have passed over Lethe. Nec accidens est Latin, and is not an attribute. Est agens, Latin, it is an agent. I'm not handing you my original research, I'm merely citing C.F. Terrell's A Companion to the Cantos of 1980. Rose in the steel dust, a pattern formed under magnetic influence, a graphic image of divine order operating in the material world. Ezra Pound had previously used the trope in a prose book of polemic, Guide to Culture, in 1938. One could perhaps say that the rose in the steel dust corresponds to, or is in complementary relation with, the nature of the vortex. But whereas the vortex is twinatured, at once creative and destructive, the rose in the steel dust is entirely benign. As if to imply this, Pound in Canto 74 associates his words with the words of one of the most ceremonially benign exemplars of English high lyric tradition, Ben Jonson's Her Triumph. How you felt the wool of the beaver or swan's down ever, poem of 1624. Again, let me travesty my situation and yours, confronted by and confronting that highly elusive passage by Pound, and ask, what do these lines mean? They mean, as does the whole of Canto 74, and indeed as do the Pisan Cantos in their entirety, that Pound is addressing himself to death, which he has reason to believe is impending, and to legacy. That legacy of various phases of the world's high cultures, and the legacy that he might himself expect to leave after his ignominious death. He'd been indicted by the US government on a charge of treason, which carried the death penalty. So light is the urging, so ordered the dark petals of iron, we who have passed over Lethe. Pound is saying, in effect, I am already a dead man. But even here, he remains an Ovidian agent of metamorphosis. A quarter century earlier, in the greatest work of the first phase of his monumental making, not Hugh Selwyn Moberly, as you may expect me to say, but homage to Sextus Propertius, in my considered opinion, in that earlier poem, he had rejected epic for lyric, only to make lyric itself epic. When and whenever death closes our eyelids, moving naked over Acheron, upon the one raft victor and conquered together, Marius and Jugurtha together, one tangle of shadows. The passing on, the making of an inheritance from poet to poet, across the generations and across the decades of a poet's own life. The ability to see death itself as a creative force by virtue of nothing more than the creation of an instantaneously perfected metaphor is what sustains some poets and some ontological readers. And if the perfected metaphor is one tangle of shadows, that too is perfectly in keeping with the poetic sense of what clarity is and what coherence. The 20th century was largely worked upon to its gathering discomfiture by twin forces of velocity and inertia. This much was intuited, though not in those precise terms, by Henry Adams, a New England patrician at once effete and steely, or steely and effete, I can't decide which order is best, as he absorbed and transmuted the mechanical glories of the cathedral at Chartres. Adams was strikingly influential on and in the earlier Eliot. These fragments I have shored against my ruins, Eliot, is a motto phrase for the grandest artistry of the century, but so also is, in the gloom the gold gathers the light against it, Pound. But so also, as a matter of fact, is, I did it, that's how it is, which is how Pound translates Clytemnestra's words after the murder of Agamemnon, very different in resonance from and sang within the bloody wood when Agamemnon cried aloud, but held and sustained along with it as an equivalent part of that noble, ill-fated turbining that I characterize as the major creative coadjutor of the age. There will be about 8 to 10 more minutes. I will probably run over the half hour by an unforgivable few seconds. If strange things happen where she is, so that men say that graves open and the dead walk, or that futurity becomes a womb and the unborn are shed, such portents are not to be wondered at, being tourbillions in time made by the strong pulling of her bladed mind through that ever-reluctant element. I quote the poem in its entirety. Its title is On Portents. Its author is Robert Graves. And no, in the second line, he is not punning on his own name any more than I am punning on my name if I happen to use the word hill. The significant turning word in this persistently turning poem, a poem about turning something to something, is the word made, line 6, of the eight-line poem, because the turning round and turning over of the erotic perplexity has made, or has made come up with, the final metaphor of a turbine which is at once the grinding of Eros, the grinding away of the troubled creative mind through the welter of its afflictions, and the capacity of the mechanism of poetry somehow, to bring you to a resolution of these involvements through the revolutions and evolutions of its own being. As one would expect, the syntax of such a poem is of major significance. The syntactical connections of the argument are in four, possibly five of the eight lines, carried by enjambment over the line endings, being tourbillons in time made by the strong pulling of her bladed mind through the ever-reluctant element. Tourbillon, French tourbillon, whirlwind, transferred sense, a whirling mass or system, a vortex, a whirl, an eddy, a whirlpool. According to my 1989 OED, which I still haul off the shelf, the first recorded use in this sense is Steel in The Spectator, number 472. Each of them, the fixed stars, is a sun moving on its axis in the center of its own vortex or tourbillon. Graves's use of the word in this poem is noted by the OED and dated 1931. What is the poem about? Well, it is about it and about. It being simultaneously sexual power, maybe the power exerted by Laura Riding on Robert Graves, and the poem which insists on being engineered and on that engineering being displayed and admired, as it is being admired by me, 81 years after its conception, when Riding's dust and Graves's dust with Waller's have been laid. Every poem that profoundly moves us, and note the verb, we are to be moved, we are moved. It is the aim and function of poetry so to move us, perhaps to move us to a rapt stillness. It's a compound of the strong pulling of that bladed mind, imaginative technique, and the recalcitrant force of that ever-reluctant element, experience as language, experienced as obstacle, allurement, consummation, in the form of what I most loutishly term semantics. As I think back through this lecture as it has come to stand thus far, I do concede a strong sense of vulnerability, not in my essential position, but in my initial insistence on the objective value of the slight framework of the Eberhard poem. Slight is a word anyone might use in claiming that I make far too much of it. Tensile is a word I might use myself in attempting to justify both its quality and effect. One style of objection might present itself thus. There are excellent phrases in the poem, e.g., all the flowers of the heart and ice flowers, but these were composed by Kierkegaard. Eberhard's own phrases are comparatively jejune and exclamatory. Was all my steadfastness, my own fighting heart, full of dismay, duplicity of man, heartache. They sound like the miserable equivalent of what is generally dismissed as trying to cheer oneself up. I would respond by saying that Eberhard has endeavored to create a dialogue between the grave, ironic cogences of Kierkegaard's journal, as made astonishingly apparent to English readers in Alexander Drew's 1938 translation, and the astonished gaucherie of an intensely susceptible, malleable American intellectual mind. At that time, in its early mid-30s, Eberhardt was born in 1904, but a mind which, though capable already of various forms of lyrical affirmation, had hitherto not encountered anything remotely like this. The subjective naivety is from the first conceded, but to reach the Archimedean point was all my steadfastness. As Kierkegaard repeatedly warns in the journal, to reach the Archimedean point, you would have to venture beyond Earth's gravitational field. And the only movement that Eberhardt can foresee as his own spiritual and metaphysical possibility is a slight one, the tug of laughter and of irony. The movement of the poem, I suggest, is in fact this, a slight tug which suffices to arrange and rearrange the small decencies of the poem around itself in the final line, though with a serious leaning towards Kierkegaard's terrifying directions. Subjective naivety, so presented, becomes, if you like, its own objective correlative. Subjective naivety, so presented, becomes its own objective correlative, which is what it has to be to make the poem. One last further excursion I will make here. It seems to me possible that this is a poem written by someone who has read Eliot's essay, Andrew Marvel, first published in 1921 when Eberhardt was 17. I think he's read that much rehearsed matter of a tough reasonableness beneath a slight lyric grace. Eberhardt's poem is what a metaphysical poem can be at a time when what was sustained thought, what was once sustained thought, has been reduced to spasmodic ejaculation. It's spasmodic ejaculation taking the measure of the dignity of sustained thought. And out of those two energies, a poem grows. It is a genuine achievement. Though, yes, the achievement is less than the achievement of, let us say, Edward Thomas, who was perhaps the best metaphysical poet writing in English during our 20th century. Three minutes overdue.